Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. My name is Marty Plum, and I am your host of a Pen and a Napkin podcast, a weekly coaching clinic you can carry around with you in your pocket. Welcome back to our interview series, episode number 278, and thrilled to have on Coach Steve Smiley, the head men's basketball coach at Northern Colorado University. I've only been chasing Coach Smiley for, I don't know, what's it been, Coach? About 4 or 5 months here as we've been going through things, but...
I mean, you were probably chasing, you're probably on episode 212, and now you're 278, so that's probably how long it's been, but certainly not dodging you, but yeah, it's been a grind.
Hey, and I'm just always appreciative of any coach, any coach, but especially coaches at higher levels where you just have so much stuff going on that you're willing to give up your time. So greatly appreciated, Coach. Before we get to Coach Smiley, we, of course, want to thank our founding sponsor, Cosac Chiropractic, located at 144th and Maple here in Omaha, Nebraska. Coaches, if you or any of your athletes are struggling with balanced neck or spinal issues, have them go see Cosac Chiropractic. Check out their practice at Cosac, K-O-S-A-K-C-H-I-R-O, CosacChiro.com. Follow us on Twitter at A Pen and a Napkin. We try to put out daily coaching tidbits on the Twitter handle, so be sure to follow us there. If you're listening, Spotify, iTunes, whatever the platform is, first of all, subscribe. Second of all, like us, review us, give us 5 stars, do nice things for A Pen and a Napkin. That is greatly, greatly appreciated. Questions, comments, suggestions, ideas, email me, apenandanapkin@gmail.com. Enough of that baloney here. Let's get to the meat and potatoes of what we are here to talk about today, and that is Coach Steve Smiley. Again, Coach, so grateful for you giving up your time here to talk some hoops here this afternoon.
Marty, it's my pleasure. I'm excited to do it, and it's funny, like, even when we set this date, it's so funny that kind of envisioned that at that point, you know, the roster would be done, and we'd be kind of cool the Jets, taking 2 or 3 weeks off to get ready for our summer, and of course, that's not what happened. We're still filling the roster right now, and I thought by this early May date we would be done, and we're not, and that's fine. But to be honest, it's nice to get on the pod and just talk some hoops, and it actually was refreshing for me too. I mean, because you know we've got our guys coming back in a few weeks, and the new season begins. So no, it's gonna be here for sure.
Well, thanks. Let's just jump right into it, Coach. For folks that are unfamiliar with your basketball journey, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you ended up being the head basketball coach there at Northern Colorado.
Yeah, how long do you want me to go and ramble on? So,
the floor is yours. That's why I tell my guests, so, the floor is yours. So,
high school in Colorado, and that's kind of part of my journey that, you know, why I love being out here so much in Northern Colorado. But I grew up, played it, and then went to school at a high school called Pomona High School, north side of Denver in Arvada, Colorado. And played for my dad. So my dad's my high school coach. So the coaching stuff's kind of been in my blood, I guess, even though I didn't realize it. Went to Northern State, got my first big lucky break, and played for the you know, infamous Don Meyer, who truly, you know, obviously he's passed on now, but, you know, considered him, you know, a mentor figure, a truth teller, just one of the most amazing human beings I've ever been around. And, you know, he didn't recruit me. I was just talking about this with my, you know, former teammate and best friend Sundance Wiggs, who's now the head coach of Wyoming. Like, he didn't recruit us. We were signed by the former head coach there, who stayed there to become the AD, and we were signed when Coach Meyer got hired. Mm-hmm. He didn't know us. We didn't know him. Played for 5 years. Had a great experience playing at a really high-level Division II program. Shout-out to Northern State, to the Wolves. And then had no interest in coaching. And I was like everyone, I was trying to, you know, be a professional player. And I was a good college player. But what you find out is, there are a lot of 6'1 players over there in Europe that, you know, there's not a high demand for guys like me. So tried it. My backup plan was to go get my master's. So I was a business school guy. So my backup plan was to get my MBA in international business. And of all places, Aberdeen, South Dakota is close enough to Canada. Whereas our fellowship agreement school was at a place called Texas A&M International. So Northern State grads could go get their MBAs at a place called Texas A&M International. Shout out to Laredo, Texas.
Isn't there a country song, as you know, in the heart of Laredo?
Very potentially. I mean, yeah, there's a lot down there. And, yeah. And so went down there. I had just gotten married, just straight from college. 1 year MBA program was one of the most, you know, in a lot of ways, one of the most influential years of my life. Just, you know, it was 98% Hispanic. And so a lot of people didn't speak English. So, you know, now I was the minority. It was a great experience for me. Had a great, great academic year, but really, I called Coach Meyer that summer going into it and said, hey, can you call whoever's head coach is down here and just, you know, I'll help out, volunteer to stay in the game. And he's like, absolutely. He was always pushing me to become a coach. And so he called a guy named Tarvish Felton. And T. Felt, still one of my best friends, most recently an assistant at New Mexico. T. Felt was the head coach of the Texas A&M International Dust Devils is what we were. We were a second year NAIA program, NAIA Division II. Mm-hmm. And so I went down there. Basically, it's kind of like a free GA. It's like everyone's looking for these grad assistant jobs. You could call it that, but there's no money. I was just a volunteer. But the beautiful thing was it was just Tarvish, myself, and then Hecky Noyola. So Hecky was the one assistant we had, and I was able to help both Hecky and Coach Felton. And so I got my hands on a lot of stuff, man. Scouting reports, player development, not so much recruiting because I was only going to be there for 1 year, but a lot of day-to-day stuff. It's funny, like 3 weeks into it, I told my wife, I said, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to be a college coach, and I'm going to finish my degree and this and that. And so we went through that. Long story short, got my next lucky hop, Paul Saylor, who's now the head coach of North Dakota. He recruited myself and Sonny to Northern State. He had just gotten his first head job at Black Hills State in a beautiful place called Spearfish, South Dakota. Yep. At that time, we were NAIA,
yep.
Division II. And now they're in the RMAC and in NCAA Division II. But he called me up in like late spring, said, hey, I just got this job. It's an awesome place. I want you to become my assistant. I was like, so went out there and I joke about it. And it's funny because it was a $7,500 job. So they were like, mate, you're a head assistant at the age of whatever, 22, 23. I don't know what it was. $7,500. But the kicker was I got an extra $10,000 because of my MBA. I could teach adjunct business classes both on campus and at the Air Force Base in Rapid City, South Dakota.
There you go. And yeah.
I was preaching as a, you know, young and middle 20-year-old guy to, you know, military personnel that had been all over the world. I'm teaching them about international business. I've never been anywhere. So you gotta like fake it till you make it. So did that. Had an awesome experience with Coach Shea. They're still one of my best friends. And then at that point, Don Meyer called me and said, I want you to become my assistant. I'm gonna create another spot based off camp money, and you gotta be an admissions rep. And so that was my entry to get back with Coach Meyer and back to the alma mater. Did that for 2 years. And then next lucky break was I got my first head job, Sheridan College, which was a you know, national powerhouse junior college in Sheridan, Wyoming. And awesome, awesome place. And I think I kind of got the job, not because of my coaching credentials. I mean, obviously having Coach Meyer was a huge thing, but because of, again, my business background, you had to be the athletic director too. So for the people listening, trying to get into it, you never know what bullet in your gun helps you out.
Yep.
And I was a finalist for that job with two much more accomplished junior college head coaches than me. But I really tried to sell to that search committee how important the athletic director part of it was, because it was, you know, Sheridan College had, I don't know, a couple hundred athletes. And then we were a sister campus with a school called Gillette College. And we were the same district called the Northern Wyoming Community College District. And I had to be the AD there too. Mm-hmm. And we were just starting sports over there. So I was the AD at two different colleges. And I sold it. Like, hey, this is important to me. I got a business background, sales, accounting, all that different stuff. And for whatever reason, they were crazy enough to hire me. That was my lucky break. I was there for 6 years. I was planning to be there for 60 years. Loved the place. I still love the place. And I thought this is kind of what we were going to do. And then got a lucky call from Randy Ray at Weber State at a weird time to get a job opportunity. It was in August. One of his assistants, Phil Beckner, who's been on a lot of these podcasts, very, you know, a person that a lot of people follow with player development, Damian Lillard's trainer, and he does a lot more than that now. Mm-hmm. With Formula Zero and stuff. He was the assistant there. He got a job with the OKC Thunder, and I actually got his job at Weber. And again, another lucky break. And it was there 2 years. We got a chance to win a Big Sky Championship, go dancing, which is what we're trying to do here in Northern Colorado. And then the biggest one, though, because I've been here 9 years going into my 10th year, is that Jeff Linder, who's one of my best friends all the way back to the high school days. And Jeff called me. Northern Colorado job just opened up. He was the associate head coach at Boise State. I was at Weber. And he just said, hey, I'm going after this job. I'm going to get it, and you're going to come with me. I was like, what?
Okay.
And And he just said, hey, we could turn this thing around. And I think we can turn it. I think you could win there. And for me, and he was from Colorado as well, but for me to get a chance to come back home, you know, my set of parents, so the kids' grandparents are still in Arvada, Colorado, then my wife is from Cheyenne, Wyoming. And shout out to Omaha too, because they actually have a family farm in Falls City, Nebraska. So we're in that neck of the woods quite a bit. But her family's in Cheyenne, and so it's like literally really Colorado, where Northern Colorado is. It's right between the two, and we knew that as our kids were starting to get into that kind of 5, 6, 7, 8 year old range, like we wanted them around the grandparents. So let's roll the dice, bet on Coach Leonard what we can do, and kind of the rest is history. He was here 4 years. I got the Wyoming job. I got lucky enough to get this job, and we found a way to kind of continue onwards. That is the cliff notes of why I'm sitting here today.
Awesome. Steve, when was your our newest category to the pod, the Karen Self a pen and a napkin moment? When do you recall the first time you started to get out a pen and either a paper or a napkin or whatever and start drawing those little X's and O's that fascinate us so much?
Well, that's really easy, actually. That's 1999, because that was my freshman year at Northern State University. For those that know Don Meyer, he was at all times.
Everybody takes notes.
And everyone takes notes. And in fact, you know, our first meeting with Coach Myers, actually myself and Sundance, we were the only two freshmen in that class. We walked into his office, and we didn't know him. He didn't know us at all. We walked in and we sat down and kind of just, we were nervous. Like, you heard a lot about this guy. And he's a dominating personality. And he looked at us, and he's like, where are your pens? And so like, we're like, what? And so we scrambled around, got some pens and papers. But like, yeah, that was 1999. And hey, I still have my 5 years of player notebooks, my 2 years of coaching notebooks, and have honestly continued on that tradition. My players have notebooks, they have pens, and so it's pretty cool to still see it. But yeah, that was 1999. We were writing down strategy notes, motivational quotes, you name it, we wrote it down.
You spent the 6 years at Sheridan. Then you were an assistant again, and then, like you said, Coach Linder moved on. You slid over 18 inches. What about being a head coach at that junior college level? What are some key things that you think you learned from that position that helped position you to be successful when you got the Division I call?
Yeah, I mean, really everything. All your experiences kind of grow to what you are, right? Like, we're just kind of like accumulation of what we've done, and what we've experienced. But Sheridan College, you know, one, it's that famous Frosty Western book, Make the Big Time Where You Are, right?
Yep.
And so
Yep.
when I pull into my interview, Sheridan College, you go down, I think it's I-80, it's the interstate, maybe even I-90, I think that's I-90. And you pull into town, the first thing you see is this big, glorious Golden Dome. And that's what it was, the Bruce Hauptmann Golden Dome. And that's where we play. I play this, like, there's two or three of them in the country, and with this awesome arena. And I walked into that place, and they were like, hey, this is like, again, a top 10, top 20 JUCO in the country. And I was like, man, we're like, this is a big deal. And so I really, I think, you know, worked at it as such. Like, this is a big thing. And so when you put so much pressure on yourself, because no one puts more pressure on you than you do, at least that's hopefully the case, because you have high expectations and you try to hold yourself accountable, that those 6 years, I mean, I'm telling you, it can be the athletic director too. Like, you know, you budget, you sell any of these smaller level places, whether it's junior college, division two, you know, any of it. It's like, you know, you got to pinch pennies, you got to be organized, you got to recruit. All those lessons, like, you know, my first tee, my first technical foul, and actually, I think it was one of my last ones. I never got one to go to Colorado. I don't know if that's a good or bad thing, but we were in the Region 9 championship game, sold out gym at Sheridan College. We hosted it, and our region had 19th Division I teams. It's the biggest region in the country. We got to the championship, and I'm 26, 27 years old. I get mad at a call, and I rip off my suit coat. I used to wear suits, bad suits, by the way. I had bad fashion, but I ripped it off and I threw it. You know, I thought that was what you're supposed to do. I got banged with a tee, and ultimately we lost to the buzzer by one. And, you know, I mean, you could say, well, that's not why you lost, but I look at it that way. Like, if I
Yeah.
didn't have a mental emotional outbreak, maybe we got to Hutch. And so I like, you got to own that stuff. And, you know, those lessons you carry on all the way through to where we're at today. And that's just one example. But I think that, you know, the junior college level is a great example. Like people say, I don't want to be a JUCO coach. I'm like, why not? Like it's, you honestly do everything. You're the strength coach. And like the key is like, if you're lucky enough to have one or two assistants, you have to find a way to get like good personnel because that assistant is everything. My first assistant was actually, his name is Luke Wicks, Sundance Wicks' younger brother. And I was able to get him up there. It's his first job after he graduated from Northern State. We were sitting in this dorm room. They had posted the dorms, and we're sitting there. And we work all day. We go over to the dorm room. We'd eat peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and Ruffles chips. To go back and work. And, like, we were in the trenches together, man. And he's literally, like, and he eventually, he got all the way up. He was, I believe, associate head coach at the University of San Francisco, like, highest level stuff. And he started as a JUCO coach. But, like, I had a great assistant. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, I think those lessons prepared me for this. You never really know what you're getting into until you do get the opportunity to slide over, and then you just dive in and go for it. Like it's a little bit intimidating at any level. Doesn't matter if you're a head JV. I think it's intimidating, but you just got to go for it. You got to be convicted.
Mm. Speaking of being convicted, you know, like you said, Coach Linder left, and. Like I said, you made that 18-inch slide over. It was a tough time for everybody. You know, March of 2020, COVID, quarantine, all of that stuff. Do you think being the assistant coach and sliding over, was that easier? Or do you think in some ways it might have been better if you were the new guy coming in and just being the head coach from the get-go? What adjustments did you have to make, Steve, going from, you know, the good guy assistant coach most of the time to, well, now I'm the head coach, now I'm making decisions?
Way easier to get hired internally, especially during that time, but I think in general too, way easier to get hired internally than to be on the outside, you know, coming to a new program. And I think that's anywhere you go. Ollie Brogman, CSU, is a good friend of mine, and you know, he got the job with DeHo, just got the Minnesota job, and we talk, and he's like, man, really, it's harder. Like, he hasn't been through a season yet, but, like, this first phase, right, of, like, recruiting, he's like, it's just not that – it wasn't that much different. And I agree with them. When you slide over, I think everything's an advantage to get, you know, the job internally, except for one, and that's kind of what you reference is, like, how do your players view you? Do they still view you as the assistant or the head coach? And I think, like, for me, you know – I had the opportunity to go with Jeff to Wyoming. It was something that was very appealing. And it really, we kind of went back and forth with my wife. Like, what was the better move? But, you know, I had those, we used to call them man conversations. I had those with the guys that were in-house. And basically what happened is I knew, at least at the time, it did come to fruition. But, you know, if I got the job, and we had a pretty old team in a good way, it was going to be experienced pretty good. I knew guys, and I'm going to miss a couple of names because I'm just doing it on the spot, but guys like Bodie Hume, Sam Mastin, Matt Johnson, Corjon Cooch, I knew they would stay. And I knew that I would have to, you know, act a little different, but not really, because I'm just going to be who I am. But I knew I had their trust. And so I knew that would make it easier. I do think when you come in from the outside, it's all brand new. It's not just your team. What makes these things hard is you got to learn who the people are on campus. Yeah. You got to learn who the people are that they're, you know, supporting and donating to your program. You got to learn the people who are helping out NIL in today's day, which wasn't the case in 2020. But, like, you have to learn so much. So when you just roll over 18 inches in your, you know, current job, current location, I think it's way easier. But you got to know how to handle that assistant head coach transition with your players, the guys that are in there right now, because that can be a problem. But it was never a problem up here.
Yeah. Youth sports today has become a billion-dollar industry nationwide, and grassroots basketball has been at the epicenter of this explosion. These days, players, parents, and handlers chase the almighty scholarship, NIL deals, and branding creation. However, there is still one place where basketball coaches and players come to develop their games without the fanfare and adulation of recruiting gurus, next-level evaluations, and social media highlight reels. It's not a basketball camp, it's a basketball school. Snow Valley Basketball School started as the brainchild of Herb Livesey, who, as a young adult, was inspired by the great Bob Cousy to start his own basketball camp. Starting in 1961 at Snow Valley Ski Resort, east of Los Angeles, before moving to Westmont College in Santa Barbara, Livesey's school was a place for the game's greatest coaches to teach the game throughout the 1970s and 80s. Two Iowans, Don Showalter and Jerry Slicus, adopted Livesey's curriculum, bringing the school to Wartburg College in Waverly, Iowa in 1994. This summer will be a celebration of its 30th anniversary of Snow Valley in the Hawkeye State. Here, over 1,400 campers will start each day before dawn and end after the sun goes down. Snow Valley Basketball School is America's longest continuously running basketball camp. It's where players come to learn and coaches come to teach. For those that come there every summer, it is the home to the Last of the Cowboys. The Last of the Cowboys, the story of Snow Valley Basketball School, will be available on Amazon on July 1st, 2025. Paperback copies will be available for $17.99, while Kindle copies will be available for pre-order for $9.99. Get to know the story of America's longest continuous basketball camp. You mentioned, Coach, the privilege that you had. I think there's only one way to describe that, and that's a privilege. I'm sure there were days it didn't feel like a privilege that you were playing for Coach Meyer. But overall, you knew that, you know, it was, you're with a legend on a day in, day out basis. You wrote a book, which I have on my bookshelf, and I've actually read it a couple of times. So, you know, playing for Coach Meyer. So if you want to know about Coach Smiley's experiences at Northern State and playing for the legendary Don Meyer, you can buy that book and check it out. I'm sure on a daily basis, you've got to be hearing Coach Meyer's voice in your ear. You're thinking about this decision or that decision. You know, just how much of that has just been a part of your journey as a coach.
Yeah, no, that's great, and it's funny because I still say some of the same phrases and quotes. And you're right; it was not easy to play for him. In fact, it was extremely hard, especially until you kind of got to the upper years and he really had your trust. I think the class of guys before Sonny and I, so when we were freshmen, they were sophomores. There was like seven guys in that initial class. And I think only Nick Schroeder, one, who's now the head coach at Maple Grove in Minnesota, high level high school in Minnesota. They do a tremendous job, but I think he was the only guy that kind of survived it. And obviously, it's for us, it was hard. But I'll tell you what, like if you were wired like Coach Meyer, we're all different personalities, but if you loved it the way he loved it, then no matter how hard he was on you at times, like you loved it. And that's why he would rock with those guys. So I think that, having that experience, obviously it was a master's class in coaching for 5 years, the player. And then I get the real benefit by helping him and being his assistant for 2 years. Mm-hmm. Then you get to see the other side of him, the goofy, like you're going to see the goofy side of Coach Meyer, especially during the season. You'll see it in camp season a little bit, but like, he was the goofiest dude in the world until he walked up to practice. He walked up to practice like he had that crazy look in his eyes, and you knew it was going down. So you didn't get to see that as much as a player, but then as an assistant coach, like it was such a different side of him. So I was blessed to kind of see both sides of that experience.
A few bad jokes, I would say, from Coach Meyer, right?
Oh, yeah, terrible ones. And then, you know, and then we had to hear him the same jokes over and over at camp, and we had to fake like they were funny. But you know what, like, now I do kind of the same thing. My kids roll their eyes and stuff. I think it's funny you referenced the book. I think you can still find it. I don't know. I mean, it's anyone that wants to buy it, you know, full disclaimer, it's not Pulitzer Prize winning material. But what's cool about it is, yeah, I wrote it when I was down in Texas my first year after playing. And that was my goal for whatever reason. Like, no one had really ever put a book on it, but Buster Olney put it like a legitimate,
oh, yeah,
how lucky you can be. Mm-hmm. That's like a professional writer. But my goal was to put something out to keep the, you know, just get the word out on him. I didn't really have any stretch or way to do that. And I wish it was back in the day of social media, so I probably would have sold a lot more. To do it, it was so much fun. And the people that like read it, what was cool is I reached out to a bunch of his old Lipscomb guys, all the guys we heard that were the legends, you know, Hutch and just all these different dudes, obviously his son Jerry Meyer. You can go, the list could go on and on and on, but to be able to reach out to those guys, they have like little stories in that book. And so like we actually kind of reconnected the two eras of Coach Meyer. That was really, really rewarding.
Mm-hmm. Well, as a guy who has written two books, I know the process that you go through and putting everything together, and it's a process, yeah, without a doubt. It's work, and it's if it were easy, everybody would do it. But here's the way, Steve, I would take a look at it. If I were you, give yourself some credit. Of all the books that have ever been written about Coach Myers, yours is the second best that's ever been done.
Yeah, you know, I could probably go toe-to-toe with Buster too and say, hey, 1A, 1B, man. So, you know, which I'm just joking, but it's funny, like, our books were kind of the basis of the movie that came out with Coach Meyer. And we actually were, you know, myself, Sonny, some other guys, we were really involved in that movie script. And that thing was trending in the direction of, like, going to the big screen. It was going to be like this epic deal. And then, you know, the finances of things kind of changed. And so it ended up kind of going straight to DVD. I have one of those DVDs, but mm-hmm. Judge Reinhold was Don Meyer. But to be a part of all that stuff was pretty cool. That was certainly not the goal of kind of doing it, but it was fun to do. And I look back too, it's like, you know, being able to have something that you worked on, it's finished. Like, yeah, like no one can ever take that away from you. That was a pretty cool experience.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I was just gonna say, how were you involved with that? You know, with the, cause I watched the movie, I think I downloaded it, two computers ago. You know, and I thought I got a chance to be around Coach Meyer on a few occasions. I went up to the coaching academy a couple of times in Aberdeen. So I was around him enough to have a stone's throw of an idea. And I thought Judge did a pretty good job of portraying him. I mean, it's hard to portray anybody perfectly, but I thought he did a pretty good job.
Yeah, it's just, the movie itself, like, we were literally with the screenwriter and all those people, like, they were, we were really involved with, okay, well, no, that's not right. This, you know, and that would be that. They kind of tried to stream it all together. And I thought the way that it was getting built up was really a great experience. And then, I don't know how all this movie stuff works, how it gets into post-production and things like that. But, you know, we were under the impression, at least initially, like, this is going to be, you know, the next Glory Road type thing, right? Like, it was going to be, like, that big of a deal. And then it kind of reeled itself back a little bit straight to DVD and which is totally fine. But yeah, it was a great experience. I remember myself, Sonny, I believe Andy Foster, who was a former Wolf.
Oh yeah. I know Andy.
Big fella Andy down there in Iowa.
Yeah.
And, you know, Bishop Heelan. And I think Kyle Schwann was involved at the time. I have to go back, but like a lot of Wolves were involved and trying to, you know, just help tweak the story so that it was accurate. And then you go to the DVD and the movie and stuff, and it was just funny. Some things were dead on, some things were not even close. You know, mm-hmm. But that's how it goes in those movies.
Speaking of, you know, Sundance, Paul, all of those guys, just the importance of true friendships in the coaching profession. I mean, you have to, anybody who thinks they can walk through this journey by themselves, I think is absolutely crazy, Steve. And I think you have to have those genuine relationships of people you can lean on and talk to and vent your frustrations about. I mean, talk about those friendships that you've built over the years.
Yeah. Those turn into like the, I'm trying to think of what the right word is, you know, mentors, but also too, like, just confidants, right? And so we're going through this like new era of basketball, and you're just trying to figure out what's going on, and you can only trust so many people, right? And so, like, I mean, literally, like, I talked to Sonny today, I talked to Coach Sayer, to Paul on Monday. Like, we talk to each other all the time, and I think it's great. And like, that's why we really don't want to play against each other, because it's not fun. Now, we had to play against Paul in the Big Sky Summit Challenge 2 years ago. We went up to Grand Forks because that's what the two leagues matched us up as. And we were both like, ugh, I don't want to do this. Now, we got lucky and pulled that one out. And, like, you're really excited. It's a huge road win, right? But then you see him and you see his family and you see his wife, Kelsey, and, like, they're just demoralized. They're like, this is miserable. Like, mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So you don't – it's not fun to play against your friends. To have people like that you go through this journey, you can't go through this journey alone. And then it's cool that they're both also head coaches in Division I. So, like, it's a lot easier to bounce the same problems on people that are at the same level, because just everything's so different in these levels, the rules and recruiting calendars and all this stuff. So it's cool to have, you know, those are two great examples that talk to those guys all the time.
Mm-hmm. Your program is in great shape right now. Made it to the conference championship game in the tournament, lost a heartbreaker after winning the regular season this year. But in today's game, it's a little bit of a blessing and a curse to make that type of run, coach, because you have some good players and you've kind of gone through the process of, unfortunately, because of kind of some NIL and the transfer rules and the way things are, you've lost a Dalton Connect and a St. Thomas to USC, just to name a couple of kids, you know.
Yeah.
How is, you know, my fear, my personal fear, and this is just me editorializing, so please, this is just my 100% opinion here. So, you know, my fear is the way that the system is the direction that it's moving is that the Northern Colorados or the Omahas who won the summit this year, they have a great season, and then other schools come in and poach their players, and it's almost like the mid-majors and the low mid-majors are becoming the feeder teams, the AA's, the AAA's for the Power 4, Power 5 schools and that type of thing. And I'm not begrudging kids for going after a good deal of taking care of themselves. By all means, they're entitled to that. And so, but I wish there was some sort of way where, hey, we've got this great team at Northern Colorado. Let's keep it together for 3 years and let's really see if not only just make the tournament, but man, let's see if we can make a Sweet 16 run and really shock the world and that type of thing. You know, how much does that play into your recruiting and handling the portal and all that other stuff?
Yeah, no, it's just changed so much. And I think even regardless of whether you win or not, it doesn't matter. If you're good players, they're going to probably get used. And it's amazing watching how it's going. And like I said, we always kind of joke, the portal gives and it takes. Sometimes you're the hammer, sometimes you're the nail, right? So, you know, everyone's like, I can't believe you lost St. Thomas. Well, we got St. Thomas out of the portal too, right? So,
yeah,
you know, we lose Dalton Connect. And then we get this guy, St. Thomas, you know, who we knew he was really talented, but at the time he'd average like, you know, 2 or 3 points a game at Loyola Chicago. So I was like, is he really that good? You know, next thing you know, he averaged 20 and 10 in our league, and he would have been the player of the year in the league had it not been Dylan Jones, who was a first-round draft pick for the OKC Thunder.
Yep.
And they had identical stats, two great players. He could have gone either way. So, yeah, I mean, you know, and then it's like now, you know, Langston Reynolds, and he's going to be up in Minnesota for Nico. But, you know, Lane gave us three great years. I thought Lane could have been the player of the year in the league this year. So what you do, you get decimated, you get decimated. That's never really stressed me out too much because it's just kind of the rules of business. What's scary, it's not so much the portal, but the NIL thing. People see it now, and I'm all for it. Like, you know, I don't have these huge opinions. Like, this is bad or good. It's just like, okay, this is what business is now. But what's a little scary is that as we're kind of going through it now, is that the money has gotten so crazy, obviously, with the revenue sharing and the opting in and
yeah.
the house settlement and what's you know projected to be out there, that at the Power 4 levels, and which that's where some of these guys are at, right? Dalton was Tennessee, and Sane was USC, and Langston's in Minnesota, and we have some other guys too, but those are great examples that you look at it and you're like, it's so much money that we don't have anything like that, that you can't even remotely compete with guys at that level. But the kicker to me is that the next round of like level that has like really still like some really impressive, you know, salary cap, if you want to call it that, like we used to be able to kind of like get in there and compete with those guys, and it's gotten harder and harder. So I just get a little bit more scared. You know, everyone says you want to stay old. Well, there's only one way to stay old, if some of your best players are getting poached, right? And it's to sign old players. Well, that means the portal, or in some cases, junior college as well. And I love junior college, obviously, you know, coached for 6 years, but last year, the three best teams in our league, us, Montana, Portland State, did not play one freshman.
Yeah.
So you could correlate that at any, you know, any way you want to. But then, so we're like, okay, we think this is part of the formula. Like, we got to stay old. And it's been really hard in this current portal season to try to replicate the magic of the past. So I just think the money's gotten so crazy. Is that sustainable? I don't know.
Yeah.
We'll see. But you're right. And it's like, you know, you can look at some AA's, AAA's, feeders, But you know what it really is, Marty, it's junior college. Like, it's just, we're all junior colleges, but everyone's got the same problems. I mean, you can be a good player in power four, so you leave.
Yep.
I just look at it like, okay, we got to go sign eight guys, two in the fall, six in the spring is what the math is for us this year. Last year, we'd sign nine guys all in the spring. That's a lot.
Yeah.
But I used to, it used to be 13 at Sheridan College. So like,
this is a walk in the park then.
Yeah, it's still way more stressful than 6 years ago, signing two guys, but it's not near as bad as junior college. So, like, it's just how you look at it, I think, how you frame it.
Yep, yep. What do you want to get better at, Steve? You know, you're as you're wrapping up here, you're finishing up shaping your team, and getting everybody in the door. When your team gets back together for the start of your fall workouts, what do you want to be better at as their coach? What's your improvement season plan?
That's a great question. And that's where the portal kills us coaches, to be honest, because usually this time of year, like, we're done, like, you know, early May, and we got about a month, even in Division One, where you're not recruiting, your guys are home, and you can, one, hit the reset button, but two, you could do professional development. And that might just be, you know, getting on, watching the DVDs. That might be studying systems. There's so much information out there, right? But the problem is, this is the honest truth, is that there's not as much time to sharpen your own saw right now. So you have to be very intentional about doing that. And I think for me, that's still a big thing, but I've had to put some of that aside. And I hate saying that, but I've had to put some of that aside until this roster is built. But I think for me, I really love where our program's at. I love, you know, I got my entire staff to go back. So there's no, you know, the staff did not hop in the portal, and I got like the best staff in the league. So they really, hide my blind spots and help me out. But that's a great question. I would say this. I'm very cognizant that as we get this new team in, that I need to be flexible with how we play on both sides of the ball. What's worked for us in the past, you know, last year we led the country in field goal percentage, had one of the best offenses in all in major basketball. We had all this different stuff that was great. But that doesn't mean that next year's roster, what we did last year, is going to work for that roster. So I've got to make sure that I'm very pliable as well and staying creative. So I think that, you know, we've settled into how we want to play in a big picture. But then, too, like, you know, off-season projects. Like, I'll do some off-season projects with my offensive coordinator, Dorian Green. Some projects with my defensive coordinator, Houston Reed, our special situations, Brett Clofield, and so on and so forth. I've got to be very, what I can't do is, I think, what, you know, whatever quote you want to use, but like, I cannot let the success of this year, this, you know, Big Sky championship trophy that's in my house, like, I got to get rid of that thing at some point. So I'm going to move that to the trophy case, because it just, you know, you get drunk on it, right? You stare at it. It's, you got to push it to the side. And I got to make sure that my edge is even better next year, because what we did last year, it's not going to be enough. We're going to have to do more. We're going to have to be better, more efficient, you know, have better IQs as staff so we can get that to the guys. So I think just, you know, once you start to get to the point where, okay, I've been here 5 years as the head coach and I love what we do, that I can't be satisfied. Like, I got to keep, you know, looking for new ways. But also, too, I believe in what we do. And, you know, change is, to me, is like stupid.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Changing, yep. You know, and improving. So if you get down like the minutia of it, I mean, I think that we're always looking at ways to keep getting our defense better. I think that's a big thing. And then too, like, just learning as quickly as we can. What do we have roster wise offensively so we can build the best system around our players' talents? Mm-hmm.
Coaches are absolutely loving our Taking Over a New Program booklet. As many of you know, I spent 2 years outside of coaching, and during that time, I hung a note card in my workspace at school that said, "Strip the house down to the studs." I took that time to really rethink and reorganize my thoughts on what it takes to run a transformational program. As I prepared for the possibility of coaching again, I organized these thoughts into this 96-page booklet. How much do I trust this booklet? I used this booklet as I went on interviews to help sell myself and my vision for what my new program would look like. If I'm using it to sell myself, why wouldn't I recommend it to you, my listeners? This booklet will help you look at any part of your program, no matter what stage you're at in your program, and help improve it in some way. It's all yours for only $15, which includes shipping and handling. For more information, email me at apenandanapkin@gmail.com. Want to know more about A Pen and a Napkin and all the resources it offers? go to a penandanapkin.com, a great resource for any coach at any level. In addition to our A Pen and a Napkin University video library options that are available to order, we have hundreds of pages of notes, from one-page handouts to book breakdowns to original coaching notes. We also have coaching links, a full catalog of every A Pen and a Napkin podcast, and ways to contribute to the growth of A Pen and a Napkin. APenandANapkin.com is a coaching resource that will help you become a better coach. Coach Smiley, you ready to talk a little John Wooden?
Let's do it.
All right. We are going to throw out here the John Wooden quote of the week here from Wooden, A Lifetime of Observations. This one, it's kind of like, it's like a two-parter. Like, I took part from here and a little bit from there. They're within a page of each other, from page 139 and 140. So I don't feel that bad of kind of breaking it up here a little bit. So, but this is my adult OCD coming into play here, Coach. So, Coach Smiley, are you ready for the John Wooden quote of the day?
I'm staring at a picture of myself and John Wooden with two handwritten letters framed in my house office. Like, I'm a big Wooden guy, so I'm pumped.
So blessed. So blessed. Here we are from Wooden, A Lifetime of Observation. The John Wooden quote of the day is, "The individuals who aren't playing much have a very important role in the development of those who are going to play more. They are needed, and you must let them know it. I tried to let them know they were important, that they were valued. All members on the team are important. Each role is so crucial."
Yeah, I mean, it's a great one. I think that's why we won our championship. This should be 16 guys on the team. And we tell these guys every year from day one, everyone's role is different. Okay, you can't have 16 leading scorers. That's impossible. Everyone's role is different. Everyone's status is the same. And that's not just the players. That's for me as the head coach, all the way down our staff, that's to our managers, everybody, our trainer, our strength coach. And so, like, what I love hearing you read that, because that's a lot like how we believe in it too. And I tell you, our players, I think that, like, culturally and chemistry-wise, they drink that Kool-Aid. We had three of our old players a couple nights ago. They had, like, a going away, like, I don't want to say party, but, like, you know, this is called a party, I guess. For our walk-on, who's a great player, because he got in the portal. We were very supportive of it because he was able to sign a full Division II scholarship. And so they had a going away for him before he leaves for a D2 school.
Perfect.
And that's like
awesome.
That dude didn't play 10 minutes this year, but he was good. But like what he did every day, he guarded our best players. He was a good player. He was the best scout team guy. And these guys, like, they love each other. So that's pretty much what it is.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I think that, you know, I love what you said there. Everyone's role is different, but everyone's status is the same. And sometimes, unfortunately, and these are the teams that are usually undone internally, is you have certain players on your team, not your 9 through 15 kids, but somebody within your 1 through 8, one or two kids that said, well, hey, I play, I should be treated a little bit differently. And you're like, no,
yes,
we're not going to do that. We're not going to bend the rules or anything like that. You know, everybody is valued. Like there was a time with one of my teams where there was something going on and we had to practice because we were getting ready for conference tournament or something like that. And but they had like ACT, and we're like, well, we're not practicing until they're done with the ACT because they're part of this team. And let's say four of these kids want to take the ACT, three of them probably weren't going to play very much in the actual game. But I'm like, they are part of this team. We are not practicing without them. And some kids got upset because we had to put off practice until like 2 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon. But I'm like, I don't care. They're part of this team. We're not adjusting this just because it's inconvenient for you and we're not going to leave them behind. How does that make them feel? Their status is the same as you. They deserve to practice that day just as much as you do.
Yes, I agree. I agree. It's good stuff for sure.
Yeah. Coach, let's get into your stuff here. Let's talk about, you know, obviously Coach Meyer, one of the most organized, I'm assuming, just by everything, and I've seen every Don Meyer DVD, I don't know how many times, you know, plan your week on Sunday, plan your day the night before, and all of those different things, and the way he organized his bench, the way he organized his program, and I'm sure a lot of those things, like say, you've probably taken that from him, but, you know, explain to us what your, you know, how does it function? How does your Northern Colorado bench function on game day? Who has what responsibilities? How do you communicate? How do you pass along ideas? Maybe how do you like your timeouts? How, you know, who talks to what players as they come off the floor? You know, just all of those things that are going on in those 40 minutes while you're out there on the floor.
Okay, so I started timeouts. I mean, timeouts is actually kind of what Coach Meyer did, so I definitely stole that one. I used it all the way to the end. I think it's just good for sport organization that, you know, when I sit down, we bring the chairs out. We have these little portable chairs. But when I sit down, directly in front of me is the point guard. To my left are, if you want to put numbers on them, are two on three, so like our wings or guards or whatever. And then to my right are the bigger players, the forward, center, post, whatever you want to call it. At least we have some organization. And then, you know, players stand behind that and kind of lock in the huddle. You know, our timeouts are long enough, you know, unless it's a 30-second, those things move quick. But they're long enough where we have a quick talk to the staff. I don't take it too far. Like, I see some staff that are out there for, like, a really long time. And I don't know what they're talking about, but God bless them. We get out there quick and just, you know, try to, you know, give me a couple things. And I have enough opinions as well, but give me a couple things. And then we kind of go from there. The scout coach usually dives into the huddle with me too. So, cause they're so dialed into the personnel. So like I might, you know, talk, drop, play, whatever it is. And the scout coach might emphasize a couple things he sees or it could be like, you know, just basic defensive stuff. Our red balls and covers the bats or reads and they're, you know, barking, or maybe our space and pace bats. So Coach Green gets them real quick. So, you know, you don't want to have too many voices in there, but, you know, two or three of us max. And then the bench itself, I don't do the deal where I split the team of the guards and the bigs. Like, they kind of find their chairs. And then, you know, I take the furthest, the chair closest to the scores table. Then I never sit. Like, honestly, I never sit after the first tip. But our roles would be like Coach Colin Goss, my operations coach. He's got to be charged with the timeouts and the fouls. And I'm always checking on that. I got a weird brain. Like, there's a lot of stuff going through my brain that I'm constantly thinking of. Coach Dondrell Campbell, he does our kills. That's the one thing we kind of chart, you know. So it happens. I'm like, how many kills we have? And a kill is just three stops in a row. And our goal is, you know, seven kills in a game. So if you get four kills in the first half, you're above pace. So we're trying to get four kills. So that's one thing we chart. And then I don't make the rest of the staff chart much of anything. I want them watching, and I want them grabbing guys, you know, on the bench and talking to them. I don't want to be charting 48 things that I don't have time for that information anyways. But, you know, you get it, Division One, you get, you know, 19 box scores, you know, given to you every 3 minutes, right? So it's like the basic stats, you know, those guys can digest that quickly. But yeah, you know, it's, and then so like I still, I'm taking input. I'm talking to, you know, my most veteran coaches, you know, Green, Reed, Clove, all the time. Hey, is it time to pull Brock out? Like, so I'm talking to him, but I don't fully delegate the subbing. I think a lot of coaches do it, and I think that's great. But just for me, like, it's two things that are always on my mind is, you know, kind of the load management, the players, like, how do I want them to sub to get the right guys at the right time? And the other thing that's always on my mind is just the score. Like, I'm fanatical for some reason, making sure that score's right. And that's why I was growing up, just staring at those stupid scoreboards all the time. And, you know, you got open gym, and it's like, nah, it's 10-2. And no, it's 9-2. Like, I've always been the guy that knew the score. So I'm always pretty dialed into that. But that's about it on the bench, I think. We don't overdo it. But that's kind of the organization.
Mm-hmm. Another thing that I'm always curious about, and you guys, you know, in theory, have a little bit more time to kind of go through. Now, don't get me wrong. When I was coaching, don't tell anybody this, but sometimes my lesson plans were a little bit not as well implemented in December and January, you know, type of thing. But, you know, implementing your scouting report. You know, putting that together, obviously you put it together, but how are you presenting that to your team? How are you on? And again, every team's different. When you're playing Montana, it might be different than when you're playing North Dakota State. But typically, how are you guys getting your guys ready for the other team and implementing them, the scouting report?
Yeah, the scouting and preparation is one of the things that I'm probably most passionate about. I know we don't have time to go through the whole thing, but like, I love the idea of the pregame, in-game, and post-game preparation, right? And how do you pregame scouting? In-game would be like adjustments, and then post-game is all the statting, analytics, recapping, you know, the breakdown. How'd you actually play? So I love kind of patching that stuff together. But, you know, the scouting stuff would be one, you know, three assistants share the scouts, basically a third. I create the scouting schedule before the season. Once our game schedule's up, I try to space it out every third game so that those guys can really prepare and own those scouts in terms of like advanced scouting. Some coaches have gone to like, well, the offense coordinator does all the offense stuff on every scout, the defensive guy does the defensive. I've thought about it. I think there's a lot of merit to it. But I don't do it that way because I just want them to own that scout. And I think, too, I don't want them to be pigeonholed and like, oh, that's just the offense guy. I want them to do the whole thing for their development as well. But really timing-wise, so the preparation is weeks, but like the implementation to the guys is just a couple of days. And what it means is, you know, if it's the first game of the week, like we play Thursday, Saturday. So on Monday, there's absolutely no scouting. It's all about us. On Tuesday, maybe we sprinkle in a little bit of stuff. And like what we'd like to do is we call it live mystery. And we'll play live. Scout team's ready, but we won't break it down to tell the guys what's coming out. We'll tell them what balls or covers to be in, things like that. But we just try to punk our guys with what it looks like, the best stuff they have. So we'll do a little bit of that, you know, live mystery and 2 days ahead. Nothing too crazy. But then what we do is after that practice, so 2 days before the game, after the practice, we will sit the guys down in the locker room or on a bench on the court, and we will play live film. Coach Ray at Weber State, Coach Linder, something we've just done. I love it. And it's just usually the most recent game or at least the most relevant game to what we're trying to do. We will play from the jump ball, the first two meetings. And so you're talking about 8 minutes, you know, 8 minutes of film. And you're just talking to us, okay, this is this guy. Okay, we just did this in the live stuff. You know, just kind of give them an idea. Then the day before the game, that's where it gets a little bit more scouty, where we try not, again, to do, it's a lot more about us than that, but we'll start practice with some 75%, you know, defending our three favorite blobs, maybe a sideline as well. And then through the course of practice, we'll sprinkle in two or three different sessions or segments where it might be the three favorite ball screen actions, it might be the three favorite screening actions, whatever. And that would be like the day before. I usually don't go live. That's up 75%. That's where you have to have a mature team where 75% does not mean 12%. You get nothing out of that. But, you know, moving, making them feel it, but not getting people hurt is a big thing. And then after that practice, that day before practice, that's when we do the personnel. The personnel for us is front and back. Okay, so we don't give them 10-page reports. We give them one page. And it's the starters on the front. It's the other four or five guys, backups on the back. You know, how they play, how we defend. It's usually three bullet points on both of those. So it's not like it's the idea of less is more, right?
Yep.
You know, Coach Meyer, he would keep all that stuff blank. He'd make us handwrite it in. I don't do that. I tried that at JUCO. These dudes were looking at me like I was crazy. So we don't do that. But, you know, and then, you know, when they have the hand report, it's also built off the film. So we go through the film. That's going to take 30 to 45 minutes, personnel. The majority of our scouting is based off of personnel, which is the majority of our defensive plan, too, is how to take away personnel. So that's the day before the game. We finish that practice. We go in. We do the film. Get them out of there. Then we still have that day of the game practice, which you could call a shoot around. And that's where I'll show them two sets of like really quick film, but I spent a lot of time organizing it. The first one would be like if we're playing South Coast State, you know, the first one would be defend the Jackrabbits. And I'll have a few concepts on there. We'll watch it on the court. Then we'll get to our, you know, hour, you know, session or whatever. And then as we eat our pregame meal, it's attack the Jackrabbits. And I'm trying to show clips on how we're trying to attack those guys. And by then the hay's in the barn and they're ready to go.
Yep.
So I think it's kind of like how we do it.
Yeah. Well, I like that phrase, attack it, you know. You know, we're not going to be, we're not preparing for them or whatever. We are going to be the aggressors. I think that verbiage, is so important to put your team in that the best mindset that you possibly can. Don't you think, Steve?
I even put like three exclamation points on it too. Like, maybe it's a little thing, but it's a big thing. It's like, you're going to attack, like attack the Jack. It's attack the Jackrabbits. Like, so yeah, I think that little phrasing over the course of, you know, Division One season, I think it matters. Like, well, this is what we want to do. Like, we're going to attack them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it matters. I think it's good for your guys.
Mm-hmm. Folks, we had a great day on April the 12th at the 5th annual A Pen and a Napkin Coaches Clinic. And if you couldn't be there, that stinks. But What's fortunate for you is we taped everything that we did. So if you are interested in ordering any of our clinic videos or all of our clinic videos from our great presenters on April the 12th, it's there for you. All you have to do is DM me on Twitter at a pen and a napkin. Email me apenandanapkin@gmail.com. We've got Andy King talking about 5-on-5 transition and controlled scrimmages. Jody Steyer from Iowa State University on player development. We've got Lucas Dollinghouse on coaching through an administrator's eyes. Wade Coulter talking about pressure defense and extending your pressure defense. Raz Vanderloo with a basketball smorgasbord of stuff from Sioux City East High School USA basketball, and Jamie Smith from Solon High School talking about shooting and shooting technique, shooting fundamentals. It's a great lineup, great coaches, great presentations. They're there for you. $10 a piece is all the videos cost. If you want to get all six of them, I'll bundle it together for you. $50 for all six videos. So coaches, if you weren't there, too bad, but because we're thinking ahead here, we've got the videos available for you. Give me a shout out. Let me know if you want to order any or all of the 5th annual A Pen and a Napkin Spring Clinic Coaches Presentations. Let's wrap it up here, Coach, with a little bit of defensive talk here. You want to talk transition defense into your half court defense, or you want to talk about half court defense and then your transition defense? It's up to you.
Nah. I think we go trans first, so that's how we build it. You know, okay. We're building both, but it's got to be transition first. I'll tell you this: like transition defense, I'm extremely passionate about it. You know, some people call like, what was that old piece, Suns offense? Was it 7 seconds or less?
Yep.
I think?
Yep.
You know, our transition defense would be 8 seconds or more. What it means is, you know, we do a lot of trans stuff, and we play a lot of 5-on-5 now with some structure in it. But the idea of 8 seconds or more is that if you can guard the first 8 seconds of the possession and not give up a good three or a layup, obviously in transition, then your defense is set and you're into the half court. So if you think about it, yeah, we got a 3 second shot clock.
Yeah.
And what we do is, like in a lot of our stuff, it's 8 and 30, it's down back. So there's different ways to do it. It's not the craziest, you know, most innovative stuff, but I love it. But like the idea of 8 seconds is the most important part of it. That Coach Leonard, he always said, hey, you're going to give up a good three in the first two passes. Well, we kind of did the math on that. If you make them pass it more than two times, it's going to be about 8 seconds. And that's what's really cool about it. So we'll put 8 seconds on the shot clock. And well, you know, the coach listening said, well, that's just going to force bad shots and off. It's good. Mm-hmm. And we understand that, but we think it's more important as we're building our transition defense to get in like, hey, well, you got to fight. You got to get back. You got to fight. And you have to win the first 8 seconds. Now, the other part of it, too, is like it's got to correlate with your rebound coverage, right? So, like for us, our rebound coverage on the offensive end, which, again, on a missed shot, your offense has got to turn to defense. But on the offensive side of things, you're one of two guys. It doesn't matter. Well, I'm the two now. Now I'm the three. It doesn't matter. You're a crash guy or you're a get back guy, which is pretty standard, but yep. You know, those get back guys, there might be one in the court, there might be two, but you just got to do your job. You crash guys, you have to do your job every time. So when we chart that, like our rebound effort has been really good through the years. We actually finished second in the country last year in not giving up offensive rebounds, and that's out of 363 teams, and we're not the most athletic team. So we spend a lot of time on a rebound deal, mm-hmm. but so your trans defense has got to build into your philosophy on crashing or getting back, right? You can't have conflicting habits. But for us, you know, when we build our defense, we start in the transition first just based on that concept. And the best way to score offensively is on turnover transition. So a lot of our stuff's not even on shot, it's on turnover transition, right?
Yeah.
Because that's an absolute disaster scramble. And you got to figure it out. So, you know, we have 4 or 5 different transition drills we love to do, and we'll do transition offense and defense live almost every practice. It's that important to us. Like, we do not skimp on that one. And really, it's like you can get in the weeds of, like, you know, loading up and this and that, but like for us, like get back guys, first guys at fullback, you know the biggest thing we say is you have to get in the paint. You've got to get in the paint. And then the second guy, you're the guy that's going to eventually declare the ball, is our phrase. and we try to get our pick a point, kind of like the volleyball spike line
Yep.
on our defensive side of half court. And so we don't want to pick them up like at the 3-point line. It's probably too much momentum going downhill. But I don't like to jam them and pick them up in the back court, because if they beat you, and usually there's some really talented guards in our league that will beat that jam guy, then you've created even more problems. I want to get our defense back and settled in. So it kind of starts with that. And then, you know, the half court stuff at this level, obviously it breaks into, you know, what do you want to do ball screen wise? What do you want to do post defense wise? You know, are you forcing the ball middle baseline or neither? For us, the cardinal sin is you can't get beat outside, which means you cannot get beat to the baseline. That doesn't mean we force middle. We want to keep things very, you know, solid, where you try to, you know, we call it win the first dribble. But still, if there's a way that we don't want to get beat, we're kind of old school. We don't want to get beat to the outside. And really, that's based off of offensively over 6 years of data with Coach Linder. We found that our highest PPS was when we got to the outside. We got to the baseline, we scored at a crazy rate. So I was like, well, crap, defensively, let's not get beat outside.
So simple, it makes sense.
Yeah, so like a lot of our stuff is based off of stats. We don't try to get too nerdy with our guys, but we're real nerdy behind the scenes. Like the analytics got to be, it's got the math's got to math. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, and then two, like, you know, we want to be in flat triangles. So we're kind of talking about half court stuff. You know, if you want to call it the theoretical one pass away, it's got to be a flat triangle, not on the line or up the line. We're not denying, but we're also not crazy deep. It's a flat triangle in the gap. We tell our guys, the biggest thing is it's got to look the same no matter who you're guarding, a driver, player, or sniper. And then on that drive towards you, that's where the real magic happens for us. It's like, okay, if a guy's driving left, right, he's on the right wing, he's driving left. First of all, the guy in the ball, he got to win the first dribble.
Yep.
You know, the less help, the better for us. But, you know, we want to be in those gaps, showing length, early visual help, you know, flat triangle. And then on that drive towards you, you got to know who you're guarding. That's why the personnel is so important. If you're guarding a driver, we call that a no split, which means that the ball handler has to run you over, or they're going to have to pass it off to that bad shooter on the perimeter. Teams are getting better now. It's stampeding. We call them missiles, but teams are getting better at kind of abusing that. But it's still hard to do. Like, if you've got a driver that can't shoot, he's on the perimeter, you have to abuse that. Then if that guy's you know, a player, can do a little bit of both, that's where like the two-handed rake comes up for us. We rake and we try to recover. And then this is not helpful. You know, another passway is going to have to help out too. But then the last thing is if you're guarding a sniper, all the help looks the same in these flat triangles. But if you're guarding a sniper, as soon as that guy starts driving towards you, we call it fanning out. You have to fan. Like, you don't bluff, stunt, rake, none of that. On that dribble, you fan out, and we try to eliminate snipers. And then I think it really helps our defense out. So that's like how it kind of builds up initially.
Perfect. And of course, all of that, like in the half court especially, you make your adjustments based on the scout too, and different things like that. Right, Steve?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And then they would call a guy a driver, and he bangs two threes in a row. I'm looking at my staff like, man, we're crazy. Let's move him to a player. And then a player could go to us. Yeah, we're very, again, pliable. We can make adjustments if we need to.
I love that when, you know, you spend 2 days, you know, hey, we're going to leave this kid open. We're going to leave this kid open. We're going to leave this kid open. Yeah. And they hit their first two open jump shots against you every single time. And then your player's like, hey, what's going on? You know, and they're panicked. It's like, ugh. Just play the percentages, you know, every dog's butt sees the sunshine sometimes. So let's, you know, let's ride it out here a little bit, fellas. Let's ride it out.
Well, then you see it in the NBA, right? With the playoffs, it's like, okay, I'm a big Denver Nuggets guy, and no one's guarding Russ. And like, okay, if he makes them, they're wide open. But then in the first round against the Clippers, the Nuggets didn't guard Chris Dunn, and it was a huge thing. So like, yeah, it's you got to ride the numbers over the course of 82 games, or in our case, 25 to 30 games. But you got it, in my opinion. They start proving it, you got to make some adjustments. You can't let that hole get too deep.
Yep, absolutely. Steve Smiley, head men's basketball coach, Northern Colorado University. Coach, I'm so, so glad we got a chance to do this. I really appreciate you being patient and me, you know, nagging you every 6 weeks or so to see if it might be a good time here. So I really thank you so much for your time.
No, I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on. This was an absolute blast.
Awesome. I was just going to say, you know, how was your first trip on a pen and a napkin? But I hope it went well.
It was good.
Awesome. Awesome. So, Coach, if you can hold the line here a second, just got to wrap up a couple of things here. Steve Smiley, head men's basketball coach, Northern Colorado University. Really, really appreciate his time. As a guy who, like I said, I've probably seen every Don Meyer DVD 10 different times in 10 different ways. So anytime I get to talk to somebody from the Coach Meyer coaching tree, I'm always excited to have that conversation. So thanks so much to Coach Smiley. Thanks so much to Cosec Chiropractic for being our founding sponsor. Follow us on Twitter at A Pen and a Napkin. Download, rate, review, again, subscribe. That all helps us out. So please do that. Questions, comments, suggestions, ideas, email me apenandanapkin@gmail.com. Again, I want to thank Coach Steve Smiley once again. Coaches, as always, let's be sure to hone our craft one day at a time.